From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The urge is so strong, most people don't fight it. In the presence of religion and religious icons, churches, temples, altars, scripture, holy relics from the Ganges riverbank to Rome, most people become reverent, not Daniel Dennett. Dennett is a philosopher on a mission, and his mission is to break religion itself open to scientific inquiry, to break the spell, in his words, of faith. And when he does, here's his first conclusion, that religion is not miraculous or supernatural, but a product of nature itself, of Darwinian evolution, like the finch's beak or the opposable thumb. If that sounds like sacrilege, maybe it is. Joining me now in the studio is Daniel Dennett, professor of philosophy at Tufts University, where he teaches courses on human consciousness and evolutionary theory. His new book, and it's making quite a stir, is Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. Dan Dennett, thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Tom.
So here you are. Talk about throwing bombs into this arena. You've got a great big one here. You open the book up right off the bat by analogy anyway, comparing religion to a brain worm.
Well, suppose you see an ant crawling up a blade of grass. You wonder, what's this ant doing? It's expending a lot of energy and working so hard to climb this blade of grass. What's in it for the ant?
And we might well see this in the dirt.
Yeah, and the answer is, or it might be, in many cases it is, there's nothing in it for the ant because the ant's brain has been invaded by a little parasite, a lancet fluke, which needs to get into the belly of a sheep or a cow to continue its life cycle. So it's climbed into the ant's brain, and it's driving the ant like an all-terrain vehicle up this blade of grass to improve its chances. Of course, it doesn't know anything about this. It doesn't know why it's doing this, but that is why it's doing it. Now, that manipulation of the host by the parasite is a bit shocking. But I want to point out that our species, Homo sapiens, our brains have been invaded not by brain worms, but by ideas. And these ideas themselves replicate differentially. Some replicate much better than others. And these ideas provoke in us all kinds of behaviors, including suicidal behavior, including giving up our chances to have our own kids. Many of the most remarkable human behaviors can't be explained in terms of any benefit to our genes. So my book isn't about genes. It's about cultural evolution and the way in which cultural evolution has turned us into such an interesting species.
Are you comparing religion to, I mean, you are comparing religion to a parasite. Are you saying religion is somehow parasitical, that it's freeloading, that it's riding on human activity? To what end? What's the evolutionary mandate that would justify that view?
Well, first of all, let me remind you that symbionts, that is, organisms that live with other organisms, include three kinds. There's parasites that are bad for us, bad for our genetic fitness.
Yeah.
Then there's mutualists, which are actually good for us. You couldn't live without the bacteria in your gut.
Right.
And then there's the ones that are neutral. It doesn't make much difference. As we sit here, we have actually trillions of symbionts in us, even if we're perfectly healthy, that don't do us any harm at all. And some of them are absolutely essential. We couldn't live without them. Now, I am saying we should look at religion as a symbiont, as a lot of different symbionts. Now, many of them may be not just good for us. We may not be able to live without them. That's a wide open possibility. So I'm not saying that religion is bad for people. It's bad for some people. It may be wonderful. It may be the most life-enhancing thing on the planet. But we can look at it through the eyes of biology, and we can look at what religions make us do and ask why. We can get under the hood and see what makes religion tick.
Dan Dennett, it's a challenging idea, and I want to try and get further into it here. When you compare religion to this brain worm, the lancet fluke, that sort of takes over the ant, uses the ant to drive its own evolutionary agenda, its own reproductive agenda, then if that's the analogy, it suggests that religion has some kind of agenda, or that religion has some need, not for human behavior necessarily, but for its own end. Well, like what? If it's not to benefit humans, how can an idea or a set of ideas, a manner of thinking or believing, have its own evolutionary agenda that humans might be vehicles driving toward?
Well, how can a brain worm have an agenda? It's pretty stupid. It's about as intelligent as a carrot, I think. You don't have to be smart. You don't have to have a mind to have an agenda. All you have to be is a replicator, something which can make many copies of itself. And then evolution will take care of the agenda. There's a limited supply of human brains.
Not so limited, but finite, true.
And there's only room for so many ideas in those brains. So without knowing anything about it, every idea in human culture is in sort of competition with every other idea for space in human brains.
Mm-hmm.
And some ideas spread and inhabit brains more effectively than others. The ones that don't spread go extinct. Most of the poetry that's ever written, read once and goes completely extinct. Some lyrics of popular songs, are spread to the brains of millions. You walk down the street and you find yourself singing a song. That meme has got into your brain, and it's rehearsing itself, it's replicating itself, and if you sing it aloud, you'll get somebody else to sing it, and pretty soon you've got a whole crowd of people singing it.
So in evolutionary terms, in Darwinist terms, we're talking, in a way, the survival of the fittest here.
Absolutely.
Does that mean, given how popular religion it is, given how widely it's practiced, that does that mean that religion is perhaps the fittest of ideas?
In fact, there's a quote in my book by a theologian, Hugh Piper, who says that the Bible wins the contest as the fittest of all texts. Look how many copies there are around the world. If you count all those Gideon Bibles and all those other Bibles and all the translations of the Bibles, that's one of the fittest texts in the world.
But when you say that religion is the fittest in evolutionary terms, it's not necessarily laudatory from you.
No more so than saying that cold viruses are very fit, or Lancet flukes, or for that matter, Homo sapiens. One of our problems today is that we've multiplied so much that we endanger the whole planet. Mm. No, this is not a term of praise. It's a term of description. It says some entities are fitter than others in the Darwinian sense. That is to say, they are better at making copies of themselves.
And a phrase of description, I would think, in the minds of many religious people, a phrase of diminution that cuts religion down to just another kind of organism, though in this case a thought organism. Speaking of quotes in your book, you also quote Ned Flanders from The Simpsons, the cartoon on TV, saying, and I wonder if this is the situation you find yourself in, saying, science, or read Dan Dennett here for science is like a blubbermouth who ruins a movie by telling you how it ends. Not everyone's going to agree. I am sure that you're describing how our understanding of religion ends. But do you find yourself being seen as an unwelcome scientific describer of religion, kind of pulling the holiness off something that many people see as far beyond scientific framing?
Oh, certainly. I have experienced a fair amount of anxiety and loathing and a certain amount of fear from many people. And I simply accept that looking at religion with the full intensity of science is a daunting prospect to anybody who's deeply religious. But I think it's important that we do it. I think we need to understand religion much better, because in the 21st century, every major problem we face, whether it's injustice or poverty or water or energy, every problem we face has a religious dimension in the following sense. The people we'll be dealing with have religions that matter a very great deal to them. Mm. If we don't understand how their religious allegiances are influencing their behavior and their attitudes, we're going to mess things up. We really need to understand what the religious enthralldom is so that we can deal effectively with it, whether we want to enhance it, whether we want to steer it, whether we want to protect it from the toxicity that some religions fall into. We'd like to know. Some religion is clearly toxic. Cults that
such
go,
as
Jonestown in Guyana,
or the
Aum Shinrikyu cult, mm-hmm, in Japan.
Poison the subway.
Everybody acknowledges that sometimes a religious sect will just go haywire and end up destroying itself and many others too. And these are dangerous times. If we grant that religion can go toxic, We want to know the conditions under which a religion goes toxic. We need to know what a healthy religion is. And to do that, we really have to put on our biological glasses and look carefully at the phenomenon.
Stephen Jay Gould said these are separate magisteria, two different realms. They need not intersect. They do not intersect. You're saying, no, break down the wall. Science has to come in and put the microscope on religion.
Actually, Steve Gould said that science and religion have different tasks, that religion does one thing, science does another. I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm not saying that science should do what religion does. I'm saying that science should study what religion does. And Gould can't disagree with that, his own claim. He claims to have studied religion enough scientifically so that in his scientific opinion, it does something other than what science does. He may be right. He may be wrong. I don't think he was a very careful student of religion. I'm saying, do the science right.
When you say in your book title, Breaking the Spell, what's the spell you're talking about?
Well, I actually talk about two different spells. The first spell, and the one that I definitely want to break, is the attitude which says, thou shalt not study religion scientifically. There is a sort of a keep your hands off, that would be sacrilegious spell. I definitely want to break that one. I think that's way overdue for being dismissed. That's part of it's a tradition. It's just wrong.
So we drag religion into the lab. All right, that's Absolutely. Number one. All right.
The second spell, and I think what a lot of people are worried about, is gee, if you break the first spell, then you're going to break the second spell, and that's the spell of religion itself. That is that people, if we look at religion with that in the harsh light of science, it will somehow disable people for religious observance, for religious allegiance. Now, a lot of people would scoff at that, and they'd say, that's preposterous. You know, science is puny compared to the power of religion. And that may be so. Other people aren't so sure. I look very closely at how likely it is that breaking the first spell would break the second spell. I think it's not very likely. I think it's very unlikely, in fact. But I think that we can take the chance. We should take the chance and break the first spell so that we can get to the bottom of what religion really is.
And here we've got to get all your cards on the table. You're an atheist,
yes.
And you have very publicly stood up in the past a couple of years ago. You wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times saying, more or less, atheists of the world unite. Don't let yourselves be pushed around. Don't let the religious dominate the political discourse. In fact, be a political pressure group, if you will, or part of the civic conversation. Are you carrying out a pro-atheist agenda here? Are you using science as a kind of battering ram to cut religion down to where it lives in your own life, your personal life?
Well, this is certainly a political book, so in one sense the answer has to be yes. I mean, I have a political agenda, and that is to even the playing field. I think that the special treatment, the privilege that's been given to religious conviction and religious assertion in the political debate is simply uncalled for. And so I want to say, look, wait a minute. Everybody has a voice, and everybody has an equal voice. And you don't get to play faith as a trump card as if this had some special moral significance.
Dan Dennett saying, Break the Spell. Breaking the Spell is the book, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. A lot of callers want to join us. I want to begin to turn to them. Dan is calling from Spokane, Washington. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Fascinating program you got once again, Tom. Thank you. Dr. Dennett, I presume. Are you aware, I presume, of the work of Michael Persinger?
Yeah. Michael Persinger is a neuroscientist who's been looking at the effect of in the brain of religion.
And where does that take you, Dan? What are you thinking?
Well, I came across Persinger a number of years ago on CBC Radio, and subsequently have talked with him and read one or more of his books. And Persinger has claimed to be able to induce in the laboratory religious experiences, or if you will, religious-like experiences.
By what, putting electrodes to the brain or something?
Exactly. And I wonder if Mr. Dennett would perhaps be interested in talking a little bit about Michael Persinger and whether or not he knows if he's still continuing his work and what his latest discoveries and claims might be.
And Dan, let us get a sense of the angle that you bring to this. If electrodes to the brain can induce religious experience, does that put you in Dan Dennett's camp, that it's a natural phenomenon, it's a scientific piece of evolution, or not?
I think I'm running right there alongside of him.
Okay, there's a thumbs up from Spokane, Washington. What about, does it matter? Does it tell us something if Persinger can induce religious experience,
I don't think it tells us very much. Any thought you think, like any tune you hum to yourself, is going to have a signature in the brain of one sort or another, and thoughts on certain topics or with certain emotional valence or power are going to look different when we look at the scans. That's obvious and shouldn't be any news to anybody. So that just follows from the fact that our brains are our minds, that our minds are what the brains do. I myself am not particularly excited by Persinger's work for that very reason. He's looking for something that we knew we'd find, and it doesn't tell us very much about religious feeling or religious experience. It tells us a little bit. I mean, for instance, I expect that there's a lot of variation in the human population for, as it were, susceptibility to religion. It's a little bit like having a musical ear. Some people are just tin ears for religion, and others aren't. For some people, it's very moving, and they're easily captivated by religion. And I dare say that we will soon uncover differences, physical differences in their brains, in their neuromodulator balances, for instance, that can account for that.
We're going to hear in a moment a voice from the world of theology, but I've got to ask you first, if you don't sometimes wonder if you're not in the grip of a kind of super Olympian condescension here. I mean, are you saying through your view here that everything we read in Scripture, whether it's Christian or from the Jewish tradition or the Islamic or you name it, all the stories, all the parables, these are all just stories of humans in the grip of evolutionary, even biological kind of syndrome. All the professions of faith, the revelations, the sense of grandeur, the sense of connection with the divine, all just synapses clicking, nothing more.
Yes, sure. And I'd say the same thing about music. All the most wonderful music. In the end, what makes it wonderful and what makes it is the way people's brains work. But that doesn't mean that's the right level to study it. Looking at the brains of musicians is important. We should certainly do it, and we can learn a great deal. But if we want to understand what makes a particular piece of music great or beautiful, that doesn't take you very far.
Are you sacrilegious by willful design?
I just am not impressed by the taboo which says don't ever state the plain truth about the natural phenomenon of religion. Of course it's a natural phenomenon.
I want to bring another voice in here because, of course, not everyone will say, of course, at that point. We're joined from Boston by Stephen Pope. He's professor of theology at Boston College. His research focuses on the significance of evolution for understanding human nature and morality from a Christian perspective. Stephen Pope, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom.
What do you make of Dan Dennett's case here? Religion, an expression of a kind of evolutionarily determined behavior. This isn't a miracle. This isn't supernatural. This is very much of the earth. How do you see that, Stephen Pope?
Well, first, it's very intriguing and I think representative of a lot of the thinking in major universities, both in the United States and in Europe. And I think Professor Dennett should be credited with a lot of clarity and a lot of intellectual integrity. In listening to him today and reading some of his other works, I think theology can go halfway with him and break the first spell. I agree with him that there's nothing to fear from science properly construed, and that from a Christian standpoint, a theological standpoint, in fact, there's an obligation to pay attention to science because we want to know as much as we can about the natural world, and science is the best way of doing that if we're talking about the empirical constituents of the natural world.
So when you say break the first spell, you're saying, fine, go ahead and look at religions through a scientific lens. No problem.
Yeah, sure. And it's been a long tradition going back to the Middle Ages and antiquity. Because the world is God's creation, science gives us a way of understanding how God has created the world and how we fit into that world. So it's actually a positive relationship between science and religion. It has not always been understood that way, and there have been tragedies. Galileo is the foremost case, but there's always any very complicated religious tradition, Western or otherwise, is going to have a lot of ambiguity and a lot of differences and cul-de-sacs. But the main thrust of the Christian tradition has been that faith and science go together. The observation of nature and faith are in harmony with one another ultimately.
But when, even when you say the world is God's creation, that puts religion in a kind of uber position here. I mean, as I read Dan Dennett, he can speak for himself, but he's almost saying, no, God is nature's creation.
Right, and that's why I say we could go with him on the first spell, but we couldn't go with the second spell. And I think the danger in his approach is twofold. One, I think there's an excessive reductionism to try to understand everything that exists in scientific terms. I think there are some things that go beyond what science can explain, given the tools and methods that science uses. Number two, there's a danger of blending science into philosophical speculation or metaphysics, and you go beyond describing theories, well-supported theories about the empirical world, to making broad generalizations about the nature of reality. And I think it's more helpful to distinguish speculation from science, even scientific speculation from metaphysics, and not to give too much weight to the speculation and to extend the authority that's given to science for its accomplishments, which are many and marvelous, to that authority to more metaphysical statements. I can give you one example.
Yes.
Professor Dennett said that biology can tell us, provides the key for telling us the difference between healthy and unhealthy religion. Now, in a sense, of course, biology is about health because health is a property of bodies. But I think if you try to limit your analysis of religion to biology, you're not going to have a help you provide a transcultural criterion for which religions are just and which religions are unjust.
Stephen Pope, if I may, let me ask you some simple things. First of all, just for the record, are you a religious believer yourself?
Yes, I am.
Do you believe that religion is supernatural, that it is maybe part of but extends beyond the realm of nature or natural laws?
Well, yes, but if I have to qualify that, because it depends on what you're counterposing nature to. You can say nature is counterposed to culture, and obviously Professor Dennett's saying this is a religion's a cultural phenomenon. At the same time, you can counterpose nature to supernature, or the word grace, or the existence of the transcendent, or God. I would say, instead of saying it's either nature or supernature, I think it makes much more sense to say, from a religious standpoint, it's both. It's both nature and supernature. It's both. We are naturally evolved to be religious. I agree with Professor Dennett on that. We have an inherent sense of wonder. They've even have examples of some primates, chimpanzees, not human primates, experiencing the awe and wonder at seeing a sun go down, just like we have primates that are pro-social and that are altruistic in some ways. We've evolved to be religious. Now, from a Christian standpoint, a theological standpoint, it would make sense that we would have this natural inclination because it's what God can respond to and evoke piety from. That is, because we're built this way, we're created this way, religion has spread all around the world, and that's why every major culture has a religious dimension. It's not because it helps people be biologically fruitful. It's because it helps people make sense of their lives and helps them learn how to love more deeply and be more just people. Not always, obviously, because religion has some horrible side effects.
And let me ask you this, and I want to get Dan in here. I'm sure he has plenty to say, but I just for the record, how far do you think science can explain religion, and where is the kind of boundary beyond which science is irrelevant or inadequate to explain religion, in your view?
Well, my view would be that natural science should be allowed to, you know, take it off the leash and see how far it can wander into the area of religion. I'm kind of skeptical about how much, say, biology can tell us about religious faith, because it's limited to talking about cells and organisms and things of that nature. I think that religion can be understood more profoundly through cultural anthropology as well as through theology. But I think it's an object that requires interdisciplinary study, and one discipline itself is not going to trump all the others.
Dan Dennett, Stephen Pope saying it's not enough to look at biology, you want to bring cultural anthropology, and he keeps this perimeter, though he's willing to let it be quite large, but at some point he says science is not up to the test. Do you accept that there's a perimeter, a boundary to science's understanding of religion?
I would agree if I thought it was just biology that was the science in question, but I include all the social sciences, certainly anthropology. But I have to say that most cultural anthropology these days is so biased and is anti-biological way that it's a lot of it is hardly worth looking at.
Really? I mean, we hear all the time now about how much of our behavior is genetically determined. It seems
well,
it's
but
all
those
over
aren't
the place.
The, those aren't the cultural anthropologists. Those are the biological anthropologists. And there's a lamentable war going on within anthropology where there's this unfortunate split between the two sides. Now, I think the cultural anthropologists have a lot of data, but I think they're just preposterous anti-evolutionary stance is blinding them to the uses that data can be put to.
Let me ask you, if religion is a product of an evolutionary process, why would it have been favored? What is it about religion that would keep it thriving and so alive? What is it about human nature or nature that would favor religion?
Oh, there's so many answers to that question. I don't know where to begin.
Just dive in.
First of all, our genetic heritage gives us a natural tendency, whenever there's something complicated in the world, something we don't understand, to treat it as an agent, as what does he want?
I mean, someone's driving. We don't know why the rain came. Someone made it came. Some creature made it come.
Or God. It's not a short step. It's a bunch of convoluted steps to get you from this overactive finding agents in the world. And that's something we share with lots of animals. I mean, if snow falls off your roof and your dog jumps up and barks, who's there?
So there's a predisposition to seeing agency, but what does religion, evolution, success would indicate? It favors populations that embrace it. It supports them. It buoys them up.
Oh no! Now you're making.
If it killed them off, so would religion die off?
Now you're making the fundamental mistake that a lot of people do when they think about what an evolutionary explanation of religion could be. You're ignoring the fact that maybe religions evolve on their own hook because they can. And they don't have to be good for us, and they don't have to be bad for us. But look, every human culture has religion. Every human culture also has the common cold. What good does that do? None, as far as we know.
Mudafer is calling from Quincy, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudafer. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What do you think?
I think Professor Daniel is kind of focusing on religion as a biological phenomenon, which I think it's totally wrong. For example, you have religion has two dimensions. One is emotional, and which you call a subjective, and the other one is objective, trying to explain truth about the world outside, and how you could explain the universe, the cosmos, which has nothing to do with biology at all. The other thing is, Professor Daniel mentioned that it's all about repeated experience evolve into a religion set. But we see that religion is totally irrational and also has kind of emotional experience.
Mudafer, let me put you and Dan Dennett on here together. Dan Dennett, Mudafer says, wait a minute. Religion has got what he calls its objective side, it's a search for truth, essentially beyond science, he's saying.
Yeah, I think he also said, if I heard him right, that religion is irrational. And then I don't see how it can be a search for truth.
No, I said rational, I'm sorry.
Oh, you're saying it's rational.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's any competition
between religious people. It's based on logic and also based on faith.
Well, insofar as it's based on logic, I think that's fine. Then it can get in the arena with science, and I welcome religious people to get in the arena with science and look at their explanations of phenomena, including cosmology.
How do you explain that there is no biology behind the evolve of the universe, I mean the creation of the universe, or the existence of the universe? The laws govern the cosmos, govern the
planet. That's a pretty big question. Let us pick it up, Mudafer. Dan Dennett?
The attempt by religions over the millennia to explain the cosmos is an interesting topic in its own right. Most of the stories that they've come up with are pretty clearly incredible today, and gradually we've replaced them with good scientific accounts of, for instance, the Big Bang, and there's widespread agreement among scientists about these theories. Now, if religions today want to get into that game, want to get into that business and use reason, fine. But when they play the faith card, they simply opt out of that game.
Stephen Pope, I saw Anthony Wallace, the anthropologist cited recently, writing in 1966, before the great resurgence of religion in the United States, saying the evolutionary future of religion is extinction. Dan Dennett might subscribe to that. I'm not sure. But what about the faith piece here? Is it durable, or does science inevitably circumscribe religion, leave its room, you know, for maneuver for existence smaller and smaller, even to the point of extinction?
That's a good question, and a big question. Ultimately, the human race is headed for extinction, so religion goes with it in that sense. But on a more serious level, I don't think the religious traditions, at least of the West, have ever thought of their cosmologies and cosmogonies as scientific explanations of the origin of the universe, because the category scientific explanation is something that arose with modern science.
Mm-hmm.
The question is there a way in which these religious traditions seek to understand our place in the world through both a deeper understanding of the religious truth that lies embedded in the ancient myths and in a way that is consistent with the findings of science regarding the empirical universe? And I think most believers that are educated realize these go together, and they're not competing, because they're not trying to do the same thing. I think Dan Dennett's critique is right for fundamentalism, as I said before, but it evades the central thrust of modern theology, which is to try to show that the truth appears in many different ways and is obtained in different methods, and doesn't just speak in the voice of science.
For many people, perhaps like our caller Mudafer just a moment ago, one way they explain their faith in religion is the unexplained, the things that science can't get to. If science keeps creeping back up our chain of understanding, does it box religion in? If we ultimately somehow, don't ask me how, come up with a scientific explanation for the existence, even the primal first existence of all, does that leave religion out of luck, Stephen Pope?
Not at all, because I think the powerful religious traditions are the ones that can assimilate truth as it emerges throughout history. And they adapt as well, and they expand their visions, they refine their understanding of doctrines in accord with the truth as we come to know it through time. So every time religion's demise is predicted, it almost always precedes a renovation and a renewal of religion. We're probably living in one of the most religious periods in the history of the world right now. And it's, I think, in part the reflection of the fact that there's something very profound in human beings that seeks to be in right relation with ultimate reality, and not just to survive and not just to reproduce. But people want to live good lives. They want to live lives of justice and wisdom. And they find that science doesn't give them wisdom for living. Science gives them information about life, but not wisdom for living.
Dan Dennett, Stephen Pope essentially saying, bring it on, your search for truth, or even scientific truth. It will not, you know, wash away the real estate for religion.
And in fact, you might be surprised to know that I agree with almost everything he said. I think he's right that people want to lead good lives. They want to be morally good. And this is one of the main motivations for why they have an allegiance to a religion. This is one of the things that I explore in the book.
Mm-hmm.
I also think he's right when he says, he didn't use the word, but religions have been evolving and evolving and evolving in response to our improved knowledge of the world, and some of them evolve more gracefully than others. Certainly there are many religions that see no reason to combat biology or the theory of evolution by natural selection. They've accepted that, and they've evolved their doctrines away from any conflict with evolutionary biology. It's pretty obvious that there are other people who refuse to countenance any such evolutionary
in
step.
This country.
There are
just
lots,
for starters.
Yes.
Let's get a call. Aaron's calling from Brookline, Massachusetts. Hi, Aaron, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to make the point that I belong to something called Reconstructionist Judaism, which actually would be pretty much in agreement with his approach. It's based on the writings of Mordecai Kaplan, who taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary, and about 70 years ago wrote a book in which he suggested that religion should be seen as a natural product of civilizations. And he went on to say that, in fact, one does not have to presuppose something that is supernatural.
So not Reform Judaism, but actually Reconstructionist Judaism. How widely is that practiced? How radical or otherwise is that seen in your community, Aaron?
Well, it's one of the smaller groups within Judaism, although it's become recognized as kind of the fourth branch.
Aaron, thanks for your call. Dan Dennett, what about it? Where do you see the weight of population? Stephen Pope is responding with a fairly liberal, open-minded attitude to what you're saying. Aaron's saying he's kind of adopted it right into his Reconstructionist Judaism. Where do you see the weight of population, the weight of thinking within, let's say, the American religious community about the ideas that you're opposing here?
Well, a few years ago, the ARIS study, that's the American Religious Identification Survey, this was back in 2001, found that it's a minority of people in America who list themselves as either religious or strongly religious.
What?
Yes, it's a minority of people. If you add those who say they have no religion at all to those who say they're somewhat religious, that makes 54% of the population.
Okay, lots of ways to slice that, yet you can feel the religiosity. You see the churches brimming to the
gills. The fastest growing group are those who have no religion.
Stephen Pope, I know we just have you for a moment more here. Your thought on this is, how far do you see this as a constructive conversation? When, to your mind, as a believer, does it become destructive?
Well, I think it's fascinating, and it's a joint of a very important set of concerns that are going to be with us from now on, because we're living in a more and more technologically and scientifically construed society. I think the big difference is whether you have a very large, capacious view of God who can work with and works through all sorts of cultural and biological and natural factors in human existence, or whether you want to regard God in an anthropomorphic way as another agent in the world that interacts with and explains the objects in the world that we see in our lives. That God is easily debunked, and it leaves you with a radical naturalism. I think the alternative view that has to be the way of the future for the mainstream religious traditions is to have an enlarged view of God and see that the insights from science are consistent with and tell us about the world that God has made, but they cannot provide an exhaustive explanation of human existence because there's more to us than science itself can explain away.
Do you think science will accept that, or is science maybe in the person of Dan Dennett or his successors going to keep coming at religion, whittling away at its turf?
Well, I don't think science either accepts it or rejects it because it's not in the domain of science. I think it's a philosophical issue, and that different philosophers take different approaches to this issue, and that's a large debate right now.
Stephen Pope, it's been great having you. You're generous with your time. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Stephen Pope, professor of theology at Boston College. Fred is calling from Middleton, Massachusetts. Hi, Fred. You're on the air.
Hi, good to talk to you both. I want to pose a hypothesis.
Please.
And find out what you think about it or know about it. Namely, that the Godhead, or any of the memes that earlier your guest was elaborating upon, that the presupposed God are actually expressions, uniquely, I guess, perhaps distinctly human expressions of the pack mentality that is always looking for the ultimate alpha leader.
Mm-hmm.
Dan Dennett?
That's one hypothesis among many. In my book, I present a sketch of an evolutionary theory of religion, building it on the work of others. And I say, this is just a sketch. It may be wrong. It probably is wrong. Replace it with a better one.
What's it look like?
And your idea of that this is part of the pack mentality is a variation on the view that it's really in the genes that we have a desire to have an alpha male, in
that
effect.
Is looking for hierarchy right up to the max.
And I don't think the evidence is there for that, although we might think about this, because I think that cultural evolution is more than able to account for the gravitation towards hierarchical leaderships, even if it weren't in our genes. To have some appreciation of something like a pecking order, it might well evolve just culturally.
So what else in your sketch, then, if not the search for the alpha and omega?
Hmm. I don't know where to begin. There's so many aspects to it.
Give us an angle or two. What else in our evolutionary past?
First of all, I think it's important to realize that there's been a huge transition in religions from what I call folk religions to organized religions. Mm-hmm. Organized religions have only been around for, a few thousand years.
And you describe them in your view, as an even more kind of sophisticated, I'm not sure what word to put on it here, but evolutionary, the equivalent of your Lancet fluke.
The main difference is that folk religions take care of themselves. They don't need Vatican councils. They don't need redesign committees. They don't need synods. They evolve without stewards.
Whereas, and once you get the stewards in, what does that say about...
Well, it domesticates religion. You see, it turns them from wild memes into domesticated memes. And this
memes,
changed,
this word again. Yes. That's a repeating pattern of thought?
That's right. Memes are replicating ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And languages are good examples. Words mm-hmm. are the best example of all of memes. They evolve. Nobody, very seldom are words invented by particular word inventors.
So religion turbocharged when it gets the infrastructure of a Vatican or a synod?
In a sense, it gets turbocharged. It gets redesigned by thoughtful thinking reasoners who are actually trying to do intelligent redesign of religion. They often botch it.
Let me get one more call here. David is calling from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Just one observation. I don't think Professor Dennett will disagree, but I want to provide maybe some clarity around why a person might adopt a theistic versus an atheistic view about what is real. Scientists may feel that, and it's essentially a question of evidence, where a scientist may say, well, the evidence that counts for me is a theory of biological evolution, and here is why I believe this.
Yep.
This leads me to say there's no God. There's no need for a God. There's no God. There's no agent, super agent acting here.
And the faithful, the religious, our time is short. David, take it to us.
Well, the theist, on the other hand, will say something to the effect of, my experience of life, subjective though it may be, is one of God breaking into my life and doing something. There is something other. There is something holy that intervenes, and my evidence, subjective though it is that he is there, and therefore I am atheist.
David, you've put it very well, and our time is so short. Let me just pick that up. Dan Dennett, you know how many people have had this experience, God breaking into my life. And to that you say, yes, respect and embrace that, or let's put the microscope on that break-in.
Oh, I say let's put the microscope on it, and let's understand the conditions under which this happens. We may find that there are, as William James said more than 100 years ago, two kinds of people. There's the people for whom religion is chronic, and there's those for whom it's acute. For some people, they have revelatory experiences, and these matter tremendously to them. Other people may even go through their lives longing for such an experience and not find it. And then there's the sort of calm religion of some people and the much more intense and agitated religion of others. Let's find out whether there's any patterns there that we can tease out.
Let's find out, says Dan Dennett. It sounds like a modest proposal. It's about as radical as you can get from another perspective. It's been great talking with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Delighted to be here.
Philosopher Dan Dennett, his new book is Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.